Okay, it is now my pleasure to introduce our next speaker. Nancy Murphy is professor of Christian philosophy at Fuller Theological Seminary, and she will be speaking to us today on cognitive science and the evolution of religion, the philosophical and theological appraisal. Thank you,
Murphy. Well, I'm not going to be talking about neuroscience. When Dennis Alexander asked me to get a paper here, he suggested that I address the arguments of Pascal Bourdieu and others who provide cognitive science accounts of the origin and persistence of religion. So some of what I say will be a bit repetitive of what Jack Schwab said this morning. At the time I was asked, I had not read much in the cognitive science of religion. From now on, I'll call it CSR. Most of my knowledge came from my gospel student, James Benswhite, who's writing a dissertation on the topic, and I'm going to be indebted very much to him throughout this paper. I'd only read short reports on Bourdieu's work, and I expected to find the real thing written for it. But, quite the contrary, his book, Religion Explained, The Evolutionary Origins of Religious Thought, is actually a fascinating book, and for a Christian who dabbles in theology, it's very thought-provoking. As he is applying his theories to what Westerners often call primitive religions, I'm saying, yes, this explains those strange beliefs and practices. But then, wait a minute, this doesn't apply to us Christians. So one way a Christian can appropriate Bourdieu at all is to say that, insofar as his theories are correct, they explain other religions. But, as Karl Barth claims, religion is a human phenomenon, while Christianity is something different altogether. I plan to take a different path, though. I'm going to try out a hypothesis that Bourdieu is giving an account of the human contributions to Christianity as well. Yes, from a theological standpoint, his naturalistic account is necessarily incomplete, but we just saw that in the picture. Here's how I'll proceed. In section one, I'll give an overview of some of Bourdieu's work. Next, I'll use Arthur Peacock's conception of theology as the top science in the hierarchy of sciences to think in abstract terms about how theology should relate to CSR. In section three, I'll present Catholic modernist George Searle's theological account of the development of religion. And then I'll show how neatly Bourdieu's work can be adopted into it. In the final section, I'll suggest some of the ways Christianity can benefit from this adoption, both theologically and practically. So first, Pascal Bourdieu and the cognitive science of religion. An important feature of Bourdieu's work is what he calls turning the question of the origin of religion upside down. We tend to seek for one origin of the many religions. Instead, he says, we need to recognize the vast number of potential religious concepts, beliefs, practices, and then explain why the ones that exist have survived. Is there something that religious concepts have in common that explains why they have persevered and been passed down to future generations? The aspect of Bourdieu's work that seems most often to catch people's attention is his theory of religious concepts as minimally counterintuitive. From cognitive science, Bourdieu introduces the idea of a template that allows for quick development of more particular concepts. We have only a small number of templates: person, animate, artifact, polluting substance, natural object, and maybe a few others. The template, for example, animal, specifies variables that need to be filled in to create a new concept, such as giraffe, its general body shape, what it eats, where it lives, how it reproduces. But the template itself carries a great deal of tacit knowledge. For example, if one female giraffe bears live young, then all of them would be expected to do so. Bourdieu's thesis regarding religious concepts is that they are anomalous in that they add a special violate one or a few characteristics contributed by the template. Some examples. A spirit violates the person template by adding to it that it has no body. A statue which one prays uses the artifact template that adds anomalous cognitive powers. An omniscient god is created from the person template with added very special cognitive powers. Fourier and others have done research in several cultures to show that concepts that are anomalous in these minimal ways are more likely to be recalled by the subject than either normal concepts or concepts that don't fit a template at all. So he claims that from among an effectively infinite number of possible religious concepts, the ones we find in the world have survived and spread because they have this feature of minimal anomalousness. They're concepts that are easily formed by a slight alteration of the template, and they happen to be more memorable simply as a result of how the human mind or brain works. In addition, we have inference systems that are turned on by different kinds of entities. These are sometimes called cognitive modules. Some examples are an agency detection system. Jeff Schloss talked about that this morning. Closely related to a system for detecting goal-directed movement, probably related to what Bill was just talking about. A system for keeping track of who is who. Systems for dealing with the physical solid objects, physical causation, and linking functions to structures. To the extent that religious concepts have enough in common with ordinary concepts, they set off these inference systems, and this makes some sets of beliefs about the relevant entities natural, and therefore likely to be understood, remembered, elaborated in specific ways, and passed on to others. There are two further aspects of Fourier's work that I'll present here. These regard morality and religious practices. Fourier says that a typical assumption by and about religious believers is that beliefs in gods and spirits comes first, and then both religious practices and moral prescriptions follow. Fourier argues that in fact, morality and religious practices take priority, and both of these make religious beliefs more plausible. For example, corpses are highly anomalous because two different inference systems give conflicting answers about how we should deal with them. The system that detects animate beings recognizes that they're no longer alive, but the person file system cannot suddenly be shut off. So the corpse is an object that needs to be disposed of, yet it's still in the drug. Religions incorporate a sort of elaborate ritual to satisfy these conflicting needs and attitudes. When rituals are related to concepts of God or spirit, participation in the ritual makes belief in the spirit easier to acquire. Regarding morality, Boyer's site studies showing that very small children in different cultures develop remarkably similar moral intuitions. By the age of three, they can distinguish between moral and conventional rules. He claims that our evolution as a social species is sufficient to explain our shared morality. However, without knowing about evolution way back then, of course, humans through the ages have needed some other explanation. Spirits or gods who know what we are doing to whom and who are interested parties in the transaction make highly credible explanations. In short, human brains have evolved to work in ways that suited us for survival in our early environments. Religious concepts, beliefs, and practices are natural byproducts of these cognitive processes. Now, as I pointed out at the beginning, our response to Boyer could be to try to evaluate the extent to which his claims are adequate to some sorts of religion, but maybe not all, and especially not mine. Animism and totemism seem to be explained easily, the natural object and artifact templates, respectively, are tagged with anomalous cognitive and agential powers. And there's actually quite a lot in Christianity that you could probably explain that way too. So now, how to relate theology and cognitive science? I found out that Peacock's model for relating theology to the sciences to be the most useful. He's taken the widely accepted model of the hierarchy of the sciences and adapted it in two ways. First, the original use of the hierarchy was to argue for reductionism. We're now in the midst of a significant worldview shift as reductionism is being replaced by an understanding of the hierarchy that recognizes the emergence of more complex systems. In these systems, there often emerge new causal patterns that exercise downward constraints on the parts of the system itself. So we can call this whole part constraint, as Peacock preferred. And this is the point where I would put off in a different direction, not contradicting, but adding to what Peter Clark said about free will. Peacock's second innovation was to argue that theology, being the science that studies the most complex of all systems, namely God and the rest of the world, should be placed at the top of the hierarchy. George Ellison and I developed this idea, creating a branching hierarchy with the natural sciences above biology in one branch and the human sciences in the other. This allows me to represent the location of cognitive science and theology in this way. So I've put it in here between neuroscience and psychology with theology up above. Now, our general understanding of the relations among sciences in the hierarchy is that first, the higher level science must be consistent with the findings of the ones below. Second, the higher level is underdetermined by the lower. Third, lower level science is often raised what Ian Barber calls boundary questions, questions that can be formulated at one level but cannot be answered without insight from the higher level science. On this account, theology needs to be consistent with CSR, or at least with those claims of CSR that turn out to be well supported. Obviously, though, from a theological perspective, we should expect cognitive science explanations of religion to be radically incomplete because they do not take divine action into account. So, I move on now to George Tyrrell's account, the theological account of the development of religion. Tyrrell was born in Dublin in 1861. He was the most prolific theologian of the Catholic modernist movement, lasting from about 1890 to 1910. This was an attempt to reconcile the Catholic heritage with the thought of the modern world. He elaborated a model of religion and its development with places for divine action, religious experience, metaphor and mystery, dogma and theology, first and second order language, and finally church authority and tradition. As his views developed over time, he first criticized the scholastic theologians of his day who were treating scripture as a book of theology and attempting to deduce further conclusions from it. He explained the distinction he wished to draw between theology and the positive faith by means of an analogy. Just as scientific knowledge about nature is distinct from nature itself, so theology, with its abstract categories, is distinct from the life of the faithful, which it is its job to explain, and different in kind from the common beliefs of the faithful expressed in vulgar anthropomorphic language. The scriptures, with positive faith, partake of this common level of expression. Next, Tyrrell addressed the development of religious knowledge. The world, he asserts, is more than the natural world. The non-physical part of reality constitutes a higher plane, the realm of freedom, will, and love, the spiritual world. Human faculties are well-suited for accumulating knowledge about nature and history, but we only grasp dimly the realities of the spiritual world, we do so by experiment. The experiment begins with the construction of moral codes. In his early work, he took this to be purely human invention. Individuals are faced with situations, and they have to decide both how they ought to feel about them and how they ought to act. After a time of observing the outcomes of these individual experiments, society is able to formulate a code regarding morality and sentiment. The truth of these schemes is their adequacy for the guidance of life and the prediction of the consequences of one's actions. Religious knowledge is then an attempt to formulate hypotheses about the spiritual world that account for the truth of the moral codes. Now later he merged his accounts of revelation and this kind of knowledge by experiment. Regarding both, he says, what is given from beyond and serves as the basis of all religious knowledge is a drive or impulse to adjust oneself to the whole that transcends the natural world. This drive resembles an instinct and allows for recognition of forces of action or thought that move one into closer harmony with the spiritual world. As science develops the code of behavior, sentiment, and society on the basis of this instinct, its members reflect upon this mode of life and develop some picture, idea, and history of the world to which this code serves to adjust our conduct. Thus, religious belief grows up to account for the religious life by providing an imagined view of the spiritual world. It explains religious practices and sentiments. He says, so far then, revelation is a knowledge derived from as well as concerning the other world, the supernatural, but its derivation is decidedly indirect. What alone is directly given from above is the spiritual craving or impulse, which is with its specific determination, with its sympathetic and antipathetic responses to the suggestions, practical or explanatory, that are presented to it. To find the object which shall explain this religious need and to bring it to full self-consciousness is the end and purpose of the whole religious process. I think this account agrees with Jeff Schloss's model two of, Dennis Alexander's model two of the origin of Christian religious belief, Hebraic religious belief. First order expressions of these experiences in the spiritual world and attempts to visualize it, including those in scripture, are in poetic or prophetic language, which is symbolic, imaginative, and precise. Christian dogmas are disordered. Theological questions arise in the attempt to systematize and unify the first order knowledge of religion and reconcile it with other knowledge, including science. Of these three elements, revelation, dogmatic expression, and theological explication, only the revelatory experience itself is guaranteed truth. Furthermore, this truth is of a practical kind. It's truth about how to live. It is approximative and preferential. It's not guaranteed to be absolute or ultimate, but only to be the alternative that moves closer to ultimate truth. So here's my picture. The yes-no experiences are the impulses that form the basis of revelation. Over time and within a community, they lead to the formation of patterns of worship, morality, and sentiment. And they're also expressed in the first-order imagistic, metaphorical language of dogmas. The patterns of worship, sentiment, and morality need explanation. Why are these the correct ways to feel, to worship, to act? Hypotheses are formed, again metaphorically, about the spiritual world, and they are confirmed insofar as they meet the test of conforming the community experientially to that reality. Scripture includes the first-order language of those who knew Christ personally. Prophetic history is a kind of narrative that tells spiritual truths and may or may not be objectively historical. This is his way of dealing with questions about the history of Genesis 1 through 11, 12 through, etc., and so on. Theology comes after the first order language and is the attempt to formulate belief and practice into a consistent system that needs to be informed by science and the rest of culture. Now, parallel. Despite the 100-year time gap, Hill shared with contemporary cognitive science the understanding of religion as a natural phenomenon, developing in history according to, quote, natural laws of religious psychology. He recognized the tendency of religious representations to be distorted by these psychological laws, and noted that Catholicism is not a rational, purified religion, but rather an eclectic mixture, a jumble of levels, not all logically consistent. So the integration of CSR into Tyrrell's theological account of religion turns out to be surprisingly easy. What CSR provides is the natural laws of religious psychology. Tyrrell's and Boyer's theories, along with the other workers in CSR that I haven't mentioned, are in fact largely complementary. In addition to the complementarity, there's significant overlap between Tyrrell's and Boyer's descriptions of religion. They agree that the only language we have for religion is drawn from the natural world and has to be adapted. Tyrrell talked about metaphor, Boyer talks about these minimally anomalous concepts. Both agree that the practices and moral codes are prior to religious beliefs. A major point of difference, though, is in their accounts of the sources of moral codes. Boyer takes the sociobiologist's line and argues that our evolutionary past accounts for a universal set of moral intuitions. Tyrrell first claims that we build moral codes slowly by trial and error. When faced with a choice, we take one of the options and then see what its consequences are for getting along in society. But more importantly, for Tyrrell, this is just the beginning of moral formation. The important developments are those that result from sensitive believers whose lives are shaped by these yes-no impulses that come from the spirit. And this brings us to the critical point where theology has to go beyond and above cognitive science. Boyer claims that religion can be explained cognitively and implies that this is all there is to it. The theologian insists that there's another agent involved, although one not entirely in control of the process. Notice the pressure that this claim puts on Christians to be able to give account of God's special divine action. Divine action has been a problem for Christians throughout the modern period, as you all know. A number of participants in the theology-science dialogue have attempted to find ways to understand special divine action that does not require intervention in the sense of violation of the laws of nature. I followed Robert Russell and others in arguing for quantum divine action. This is the view that God determines what would otherwise have been intrinsically indeterminate events at the quantum level. Quantum divine action has many critics, but as the discussion stands at the moment, none is taken to be definitive. And don't ask me any questions about this afterwards, because the discussion has gone so far beyond my level of physics that I just have to take other people's word for it. Now, many theologians debate the problem of divine action by emphasizing a dualist account of humans and postulating that God works in the world only by communication of souls or minds. Many of you know that I am famous or infamous for rejecting dualism in favor of a non-reactive physicalist account of humans. Thus, however crude or incongruous it may sound, I need to argue that God communicates with us by orchestrating events in our brains at the quantum level to produce subtle effects on our thoughts, imaginations, and emotions. It's possible, in fact, to integrate my theory of religious experience with Tyrrell's. Tyrrell says, what alone is directly given from above is the spiritual craving or impulse with its specific determination, with its sympathetic and antipathetic responses to the suggestions, practical or explanatory, that are presented to it. Here's my physicalist translation of Thoreau's account of communication with God. Either by deliberate reflection or spontaneously, and perhaps this spontaneous process is just as the cognitive scientists describe, an idea of God or spiritual things comes to mind, or a plan of action. This means that a complex neural sensing has been activated. God's response is to affect the brain by means of an orchestration of events at the quantum level so as to produce either a positive or a negative impulse. Notice that this whole process is dependent on culture and language. The richer the religious culture, the more sophisticated and appropriate the images and symbols may be, the more discerning the plans for action. With fewer resources, God's ability to communicate is proportionally decreased. Cyril says that this form of direction is approximative and preferential rather than direct. This theory helps to explain the persisting variety of religions and the fact that religious experiences are almost always consistent with the expectations and beliefs of the traditions to which the devotee belongs. God does not produce the experience, culture and imagination do, and now we can add that they may well do so in the first instance as a consequence of the way cognitive operators work. God merely ratifies or vetoes, and even then, only when the human subject is sensitive to those impulses. So this is an account of the origin of at least some religious representations. If it has merit, it justifies my claim that there's a further level of analysis beyond the individual and cultural, namely the theological, that needs to be taken into account in the development of the persistence of religion. Now, practical and theological benefits. Okay. Let me just, I'm going to skip some of this. One of the interesting things, Boyer himself provides good advice to evangelists. He says, avoid bombarding people with pungent and coherent arguments for particular metaphysical claims, and provide them instead with many occasions where the claims in question can be used to produce relevant interpretations of particular situations. So we could read all of this literature for practical advice in order to produce more effective ministries. I'm going to mention two theological uses if I've got time. First, it's often said that Jesus can be understood in part as purifying the Judaism of his day. Cognitive science theories of the sorts of religious beliefs that come naturally to people give us a perspective for evaluating this claim. Here are just two suggestions. Boyer has a chapter on how people come to attribute misfortune to God. While Christians don't reject the possibility that some human suffering does come from God as punishment from sin, notice that in the story of the man born blind, Jesus contradicts the assumption that his blindness must be a consequence of either his or his parents' sin. Second, much of what scientists call religion, Christians would call magic. Cognitive scientists take it to be the feature of all religion that it's an attempt to control God or other spiritual beings. Jesus follows a long line of prophets in rejecting the view that rituals have direct causal effects on God. The sacrifices God requires are justice and mercy. And I'll just remind you that hidden within what I've said already are a lot of resources for Christians to understand the plurality of religions without resorting to the older evangelical fundamentalist view that they must all be demonic, or else moving to the inclusivist view that all religions are really the same. It would give us a criterion for helping to sort out some of the, many of the human elements, and then as we Christians claim to have knowledge of how the Spirit of God works in our midst, we can actually look empirically to see the extent that we find God's Spirit working to purify those other religions of what we would see as pure human elements. And I'll stop there.
Physics
to know how God could orchestrate enough quantum events in order to make that happen. And then when you got the, what I'm trying to do is give an account of what the atheists used against us as a denial of the significance of religious experience. It's all pure suggestion because we've all got these ideas floating around in our heads and we're highly suggestible people and we produce them ourselves. And so the reason I'm interested in the civilian account that says, yes, we do produce the content of it, and then God just says yes or no, I'm in favor of that because it works so well in the atheistic world. For me to provide an account of how she came to have that particular Christian experience without having her cognitive system stop with Christian imagery, that's farther away from what I can manage now. And there are people sitting here I know who think that even a little bit upset about divine action in the brain is.
I follow up a question having to do with this idea of divine action. As you read the New Testament and Old Testament, there are many things there that don't seem to be sort of this quantum step away from deism. And I'm wondering, how would you interpret those in light of divine action sort of criteria that you're applying today? Because it seems like there have been theories that seem to confound that, unless you do lots of hand waving.
Well, what I'm hoping is that going to happen in the future is this. First of all, if you hang around typical middle-of-the-road Christians, not the far-out liberal ones who don't believe in any special divine action, and not the ones who are at the opposite end, whatever that is, but kind of the typical ordinary Christian believers, you do have a sense that there are some kinds of things that we that make sense for us to pray for, and other things that we just don't pray for. So that's one category. Also, the miracle accounts in the New Testament, the biblical scholars look at the individual miracles one at a time, and they look at the textual evidence and ask, how likely is this to have some historical content versus being something that's used entirely for theological purposes. And so the changing of the water to wine in Canaan is at the wedding feast is taken as one that is very unlikely to have historical basis on textual level because it doesn't show up in all of the old sources and it tends to be moved around when you do find it in the old sources. And so what I'm hoping is going to happen in the future is the kinds of things that it becomes somewhat credible that we can attempt through via quantum divine action will turn out to fit with the kinds of things Christians expect God to do for us now, and also the miracle accounts in the New Testament that the scholars think are most likely to have some historical center.
How does this apply to the resurrection then? I can ask just
a question. Oh, now that.
Because it seems to me that that's the 500 pound gorilla, the other one's all the
taste. Absolutely. And Craig Boyd ended his talk last time with the Vicky Shin and Dickett, where we cannot speak, there we must be silent. And the part of Christian doctrine about which we have to come closest to being silent is eschatology. And if theologians such as Burkhard Kronenberg are correct, the resurrection of Jesus is an eschatological event taken, in a sense, imported from the end of history, the total transformation of reality as we know it, and brought into the middle of history as we know it. And so the only way, as my former husband James McClendon said, that we can talk about eschatological reality is we put a variety of pictures of them, none of which can possibly picture what we're looking forward to eschatologically, and we just get a rather vague sense of where human history is pointing. So I take the resurrection of Jesus to be as radically different from, say, the raising of Lazarus as two events could possibly be.
Thank you. One, time for one more question. I think someone has their hand in the back.
In in some of your early writings, I think you and your colleagues have preferred that chaos rather than quantum divine action. What has shifted your thinking?
I was never one of those colleagues. I've been haranguing and harassing the people who've made those arguments for years. I'm done, John. So no, I'm not changing my mind. However, I do think that once you get into macro level phenomena, I still haven't been convinced that it could not be the case that some very, very small events could be amplified by chaotic processes.